Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Finance and Taxation Section of the Constitutional Review Meeting. My name is Eric Wolfhorst. I'm the moderator, and I'm frankly a stand-in for another more appropriate choice of the Finance and Taxation panel as moderator. That was Mr. Elmer Rasmussen, who could not make it today. I was 2 years Commissioner of Revenue in Juneau, and now I'm a practicing attorney in Anchorage. On my direct left is Sterling Gallagher, who is currently Commissioner of Revenue of the state of Alaska, with both investment responsibilities and the chief administrator of the state tax laws. Mr. Gallagher, prior to that, assuming that position, almost 2 years ago, was the controller for Alaska Bank of Commerce in Anchorage. Next to him is Mr. Nerland, who was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention in 1955, a longtime Fairbanks resident whom I'm sure many of you know, with many positions, public and private, to his credit, including having served as mayor of the city of Fairbanks for some 2 years. Next to him, Mr. Barry White, also a delegate to the Alaska Constitutional Convention, an Anchorage businessman, a graduate of Harvard University, and president of Operation Statehood. Next to him, gentlemen you all know, Mr. Stephen Cooper, member of the Alaska House of Representatives from this city. He was educated at the University of North Carolina, receiving a law degree there in 1963, and is of course admitted to practice both in Alaska as well as in the Commonwealth of Virginia. He has served on the House Finance Committee, so we're very pleased to have him here with us today. Just to his left, Mr. Stanley Erickson, a resident of Anchorage since 1951 and noted for his active community service there. He was with the Federal Aviation Administration until his retirement in 1972 as Chief of Management Analysis Activities for that agency's Alaska region. He's been active in Anchorage for two decades, serving on the Fiscal Review Commission for both the Anchorage School District and the City of Anchorage, as well as other local government commissions. Finally, and we're very pleased to have at the far end of the table to assist in giving us a background of the Constitutional Convention and his involvement with that, Mr. Frank Barr, a Fairbanks resident for many years, three terms on the territorial Senate, and currently a resident of the state of Oregon. As you know, we're scheduled this afternoon for 3 hours between now and 5 o'clock, and we will have ample time for public questioning and indeed public argument. When you do, when that time does come, please proceed to the microphone and do identify yourself. It makes it easier for the transcription here as it comes later. Format. And this is something I've been advised of, but I agree with as well, will be for the delegates to give us a brief summary of their experiences in connection with the drafting of the finance and taxation article. We'll really allow them to take as long with that subject as they wish, and we'll next proceed to Mr. Commissioner Sterling Gallagher to talk on current experiences, his recent experience, both with the taxation and finance article. As well, we'll then proceed, I think, in appropriate fashion to a member of the legislature, Mr. Cooper, who will give us the benefit of his experience on the House Finance Committee and the operation of those articles in action. We'll finally follow up with Mr. Erickson, who can give us insights from his fiscal management background, and proceed at that point to public discussion, comment, what have you. I think it probably would go best if the speakers did have more or less a clear shot with their expression of their views and their background. Just by way of summary, this particular article is not a lengthy one in our state constitution, but it's one, of course, of immense import to all Alaskans, whether they know it or not. The article in dealing with state debt was a subject of considerable debate. As you know, all debt in Alaska, state and local government. Excuse me, Mr. Frank Murkowski, who, since he arrived last and apparently does have to leave us, what, in about an hour and a half, Frank?
Thank you, yes.
All right. He'll be the final of the speakers. We'll excuse him then. He has another meeting, which I think he's in fact chairing today. Frank Murkowski was the Commissioner of Economic Development, I believe, for 4 years, Frank?
3 years.
3 years. He's currently well known to you as the president or chairman of the Alaska National Bank. Getting back to the article itself, the principal features, of course, state debt must be voted, state debt for capital improvements must be voted by the people, local government debt must be voted by the people. In a state such as ours with vast unmet capital needs, the amount and manner of contracting debt is a subject of intense interest every election time. We'll have discussion on how those articles came to be and the rationale for them as opposed to other kinds of limitations on borrowing money for capital improvements. The state budget article, the executive budget, is a subject matter of this, properly a subject matter of this discussion this afternoon. We'll hear some comment on the reason for the executive budget in Section 12, how it functions legislatively, how it functions administratively in the executive. Finally, and I think probably a most topical interest, we'll have a discussion of the constitutional prohibition against dedication of funds. The executive budget, of course, contemplates that there will be a substantial amount of revenue not already segregated away, if you will, from legislative appropriation. And this, of course, had very sound historical reasons, I believe, which will be spoken to by the delegates. This year, the voters will have before them a proposition which says that 25% of royalties from our minerals in this state will be placed in a permanent fund, should the voters pass the proposition, to be spent for income-producing investments as determined by the state legislature. I believe this is a very major proposition to come before the people. It's got very substantial ramifications for the whole executive legislative dichotomy in the state. There are very strong philosophical reasons one could bring to bear for and against passage of the amendment. In any event, it is a departure from what the constitutional framers devised some 20 years ago, and I think most very appropriately should be developed this afternoon, and I hope we do have some good discussion on it. With that, I'll turn to Mr. White or Mr. Nerland, whoever chooses to lead off with a little background of how these articles came to be, some of the discussion and debate in the convention some 20 years ago, and any general observations they wish to make on the subject. Would you care to lead off?
I'm Leslie Nerland. We have four of our seven members of this Finance and Taxation Committee who are attending the convention reunion here. One of our members, Dorothy Oz Holland, was involved in another committee meeting this afternoon, so there are just three of us, Barry White and Frank Farr. And I've asked both of them to sit here at the table to participate in this discussion. One of the reasons I'm asking them to do that is that my small trunk full of papers that I brought away from the Constitutional Convention were stored down in the lower floor of our store down in Fairbanks, and I put them way up high next to the ceiling because I didn't want any high water water seepage to get in there, not thinking about anything any more treacherous than that. They lasted there for 11 years, and then the 1967 flood came along and ruined the whole thing. Along with it, my memory has waned considerably regarding many of the details of the convention and our meetings and the pros and cons regarding our particular section. So that is why I've also asked Barry White and Frank Barr to participate here today. We, at the time that the convention was concluded in our section and the other sections were approved by the convention, we felt that we had made quite a concise article of the finance and taxation section, and felt that we feel now that it stood up well during the 20 years or more that it's been since it was finally adopted into the Constitution. We do have a paper that we submitted with a committee proposal to the convention that was done on December 16th, 1955, and with it are a list of commentaries on the article by way of explanation and so forth. And I'll ask Barry White if he will start covering those items. Is that
Mr. Nero, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how many of you have a copy of the Finance and Taxation article with you. I rather suspect that questions from the from the audience will develop areas of interest. So perhaps the best thing to do would be to go through the Article 9 by section and perhaps pick out some of the highlights or some of the areas where our Constitution differs from others. First area where the Alaska Constitution differs from others is in Section 2, which says the lands and other property belonging to citizens of the United States residing without the state shall never be taxed at a higher rate than the lands and other property belonging to the residents of the state. One's initial reaction to reading this is, so what? And even someone not familiar with constitutional law would suspect that the U.S. Constitution would protect this. But I picked this up because it's a little bit interesting in illustrating one of the areas of problem we had to consider. And that is, remember, we were drafting a constitution for a state yet to be in advance of the passage by the Congress of any enabling act. We had to anticipate as best we could the needs of our Constitution to meet the demands of a final statehood bill so that we wouldn't have to write or call another constitutional convention and draft a constitution all over again. All right, this particular section was to be found in almost every enabling act before the Congress. And I suspect the reason that was there is that statehood opponents, absentee owners of interest in Alaska, were hedging their bets, opposing statehood on the one hand, and trying to protect their interests on the other hand should we finally get an enabling act. And they wanted to make sure the Alaska Constitution assured them of equal protection. That's the sole reason for that being there. Standards for appraisal of all property assessed by the state or its political subdivisions shall be prescribed by law. This appears, I think, in no other state constitution. It probably involved more discussion on the floor of the convention than any other article. All of the discussion, as I reread it now, seems to have come because various delegates tried to turn this into a uniformity clause. Dartmouth theorists are enamored with uniformity clauses in taxation articles. But the problem that we ran into there is that it opens up a whole can of worms, really, that's very difficult to deal with in a constitution without drafting pages and pages of constitutional provisions. Uniformity, of course, gets to graduated taxes and all that sort of area. What we tried to do here was to make sure that when properties are assessed for taxation purposes, that whether it be the state or local government units, are all talking the same language. Really, that's all that we tried to do. Section 4 on exemptions from taxation probably differed from most constitutions only in that it tried to make very clear that when a traditionally or constitutionally tax-exempt body tried to use any or part of their property for profit, that would not be tax-exempt. Lots of constitutions, state constitutions, are silent on the subject or are not clear. We wanted to make sure that property properly used for tax-exempt purposes would be tax-exempt. Then, if tax-exempt entities try to get into the profit-making process, then that part of the property would be taxable. Section 7 has to deal with dedicated funds, and I'm sure that we'll get a number of questions on this. I think the convention was very clear in its mind in feeling that good government in the area of finance and taxation called for a minimum of dedication of funds. I think the convention felt that you cannot constitutionalize or legislate good fiscal management. You can do it only by electing responsible people to raise your, levy your taxes and spend the money. Exceptions in this section were two. One perhaps was in the nature of a compromise, which was to continue dedicated territorial dedicated funds in being at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. I think probably that's self-explanatory. You can understand the reasoning for it, both practical and theoretical. The other was to exempt funds that have to be earmarked in order to receive federal funds. There were two at the time that come to my mind, both in the area of wildlife and fisheries, where when Alaska became a state, it, as a state, would automatically begin to receive federal funds in these areas, but the federal legislation required earmarking of certain licenses and receipts within the state of Alaska in order to obtain those funds. There was a great deal of debate in committee and on the floor as to restrictions on the contraction of debt. I think some of the political idealists and theorists among us would like to have seen no restrictions on the contraction of debt, particularly at the local government level. But the majority of the convention, and this section was finally passed 55-0, the majority of the convention felt that where the general credit of the state would be the backing for bond issues, people ought to have a chance to express their opinion. I can remember, as I'm sure you can, Mr. Chairman, that it was said many times that old voters never turned down a bond issue. I think in recent years we have seen that that's no longer the case. There was a great deal of pressure. I remember to have three quarters of the legislature in joint session or of each house able to pass and contract debt without going to the voters. In any event, this did receive a great deal of attention, and the convention felt strongly that debt, except where the debt was being incurred for a purpose, other than the general treasury, what am I trying to say? Where the money would be spent on a project where the project itself served as the security for the debt. In this area, we did not require that it go before the voters for approval. Chairman of the panel mentioned the matter of the governor having to submit a budget to the legislature, and with that, proposals for revenue to meet the budget. I think that's fairly standard in most state constitutions. I think here we want to make it very clear that the governor would have that responsibility, both in proposing expenditures and telling the state legislature how he would like to see the money raised, for two reasons. One, I think this constitution is known as one which provides for a strong executive, and perhaps this section goes to that subject. And also, I think in our constitution, we try to make very clear at every opportunity where the separation of powers should be, where the responsibilities lay. In my memory, Mr. Chairman, those are the areas where our article differed from other state articles, the areas that received good amount of attention. I think most of the other sections are fairly standard.
That's very helpful indeed to have a sort of a pricey rundown. Appreciate it very much.
Frank, just a minute. Frank, do you have any additions to that?
Yes, I might make a few comments. First, all this happened 20 years ago, and unfortunately, that makes me 20 years older. And my memory is a little bit spotty, and I naturally remember things of which I had the most interest. I remember especially here on the legislative post audit. This is really a good section that some states don't have. There's an independent auditor appointed by the legislature, and he's responsible and makes reports to the legislature and the governor. In other words, the department heads, those who spend the money, they have no influence over the auditor. So there's a constant check kept on the expenditure of money. In fact, there are quite a few good paragraphs here. I remember in committee, one of our main aims was to see that everything was done in fairness to every person in every department, and especially that taxation should be equal to all. There is one paragraph here that talks about equal taxation for non-residents, but that was just one phase. We were particularly interested in equal assessment on property and that sort of thing, feeling that everyone should share his burden of the expense of government. And I remember also some state constitutions put money figures in the constitution. And a ridiculous example was brought up to us where one constitution set the governor's salary and in figures. Well, you can imagine what that would be now. It wouldn't be enough to pay the office boy, because the value of money increases and decreases, usually decreases. So we thought that there should be no figures in there. We should tell the legislature what to do. After all, the Constitution is just a statement of policy. We expected the legislature to carry on the government and administer the details. So you'll see no figures in here. Now, I've always been interested in a state highway, and I served four sessions in the Senate, and we had earmarked funds for the highways. And I was always been in the transportation business, although not on the highways. And some people thought that was wrong, to have earmarked funds for highways. But that was a special case. In construction of highways, they had to know how much money they had before they could make plans or to let contracts. And if they depended on an appropriation every legislative year, they didn't know what they had to work with. And in this country, of course, a construction season is over with pretty soon, and then they'd have to wait till next year. And the revenue from the gasoline tax, of course, is derived from the highways, and it only seems fair that it should be put back on the highways. And that's the reason you have highways now, is because of that, those earmarked funds, I believe. Now, in spite of the fact that I always fought for that highway fund, in principle, I'm against dedicated funds and always have been. I thought that this highway fund was a special case. And when we speak of establishing a permanent fund from the oil revenues, let me say that I'm not really a student of this, but in principle, I am for that fund. But I still don't believe that it's necessary to establish it by an amendment to the Constitution. After all, we must remember that the Constitution is a long-range statement of policy, and the legislature can do all the necessary things to carry out the administration of the government. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Thank your next Commissioner Gallagher. Before you launch in, excuse me, I should say that I should have said initially, and in addition to the review which we've just had from the delegates, the other speakers will concentrate her advice from Mr. Fisher on overview of principal developments and problems in statehood and a review of current and anticipated critical issues and problems, of which this permanent fund, of course, is the one that's most timely and topical. So we'll go forward with Commissioner Gallagher.
I have, when I knew I was coming here, I turned my research section loose and went to have them go back and look at the change in the operating budget over the last since statehood. And what I have here, and I'll pass it out to people, one is the operating budget as such without the capital projects in it. And then I have one that shows the operating budget plus the capital projects plus the federal funds, all it. And you can see, and it's all put back into real dollars, $1960 dollars. And you'll get maybe a different perspective on the state's budget than you sometimes perceive it's happening. One of the things is, it shows, Eric, here is, there's two sheets. One is the operating evidence. And one of the things is, in 1960, we had a resident population of 226,000. And the last year I have this complete for is 1975. And we have 377,000. A huge increase in the number of population. But also, there's a 71% increase in, or the decrease in the value of the dollar in the same time. So we tried to put the budget back on a real dollar basis. And what you find in the operating budget is that, in a real sense, the operating budget per capita has gone up seven times since statehood. When you include federal funds, capital, and operating, you have it going up maybe eight to nine times. But that's the sort of increase we've had. A lot of people thought the big increase has come in the last few years. That isn't quite true. The big increase, there were large increases in the budget all through the years. In fact, the rate of change in the last few years is smaller In fact, in the last 3 or 4 years, the rate of change in real per capita spending is almost zero. I think that one of the things that I don't think the legislature was being especially conscious of this when they were doing it, but I think when they saw the enormity of when the numbers changing, they said, oh, we can't spend more than another 10 or 15 or 30 million dollars, or we can't spend another 50 million dollars next year and come away with a view of being fiscally responsible. Well, what in fact happened is they didn't, in the last few years, increase the level of funding much at all. In fact, if you include federal funds, you actually see it marginally decline over the last few years. As we look in the future, there's a big driver in the next few years' budget, and that's the Alaska Land Claims Settlement Act, and we'll, of course, be paying that over the next 6 years. That will be paid off by 1981, that's the total $500 million. Next year is $58 million, and that goes up to $90, $110, $110. I think we'll get a couple more numbers, and it's all paid off. another comment I might make is that there is a provision in the Constitution as to state agency debt that the legislature may appropriate it. One of the things that it's allowed is something like ASHA to come into existence, where there's over $100 million of state debt outstanding, which is really debt of the state that was never voted on by the people. I'm not going to speak to the rightness or wrongness of it, but there is considerably more debt outstanding than this state's general obligation. One other little provision in the Constitution that is in the taxation and finance section that bears on taxation and finance is the one on retirement, your accrued benefits under your retirement system. And currently, both of the teachers and the public employees are greatly underfunded. Some one to the tune of 64% funded, and the other one 49%. One has an unfunded liability of around $80 million, and the other one around $29 million. Those facts are its contingent liability, or a real liability on the state's books that has to be amortized over time. So we have a provision in the Constitution that we cannot dilute this any accrued benefit to this time. So we should be aware that we have this outstanding debt that too has to be paid off. That's really the extent of my comment.
All right, good. Thank you, sir. I think we had Representative next to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, what we're doing here today is to make a sort of a preliminary inquiry into matters that might conceivably be considered by a future constitutional convention. And every time people start talking about another constitutional convention, I get kind of nervous because I've had a number of opportunities to participate in legislation and in litigation that involves an interpretation of this Constitution, and to me it's one of the best that exists in the United States. It's clear, it's precise, it's flexible, and I might add its flexibility is aided by a Supreme Court that's regarded as being one of the best in the country, and so I've got kind of mixed feelings about all of this. However, assuming that a constitutional convention will take place in the future, probably the best thing to do is to start right now to discuss those things that might be taken up at that constitutional convention. I got in kind of late in the area of public finance. I was
elected just 2 years ago and had nothing to do with government before that. And I was placed on the House Finance Committee, and they showed me the budget documents, which I didn't understand and couldn't read immediately anyhow. And they also said, well, we've got a little job for you here, and we got this little problem. We're going to run out of money, and we need $400 million in the next 2 years, and you're in charge of getting it. And that was, I said, oh. And so anyway, that was the occasion for the creation of the Subcommittee on Revenue Sources, which was a target quite a while. So anyway, we went through any number of possibilities. The first thing that I thought of, you know, like anybody else that grew up in a fairly conservative sort of neighborhood, I grew up in North Carolina, you know, I said, well, why don't we just stop spending all the money that we've been spending lately? And it developed that in order to bring the budget back into line so that we wouldn't have to impose an additional revenue measure, that we would pretty well have to close the schools, cut the law enforcement forces perhaps in half, and do a lot of things that I think would have been intolerable to the people in the state of Alaska. So we batted things back and forth, and ultimately we came up with a tax that is not a good one, but it works for 2 years. It's a reserves tax, and there was a lot of controversy, a lot of hassling back and forth between members of the legislature, representatives of the oil industry, but the representatives of the industry said that the bill would never work. It couldn't be administered. Well, of course, we did pass the bill. It is working. It is not being litigated, and so that much more money went into the Treasury to cover up that deficit that occurred when the pipeline didn't go on stream as planned. Well, I would like to think that governments can plan things a little better than that. But we, of course, were required to look into state spending patterns of necessity because of that situation that we, most of us, being first-year legislators, we just stepped right into it. That was our legacy. And so we were required to take a look at spending patterns there and to figure out ways in which public spending could be controlled. Now, one of the first things that was considered was the permanent fund concept. The concept was not a new one. It was advanced during the course of previous legislatures. And perhaps because the situation was not as I won't say desperate exactly, but it was not as crucial, we'll say, several years ago, the concept was largely discarded by people who thought that the legislature should have 100% control over public spending. Looking back over that and the depletion of the $900 million fund that the state got, you stepped on Stan's toe there. Didn't have anything to do with it. Well, looking back, if we had done it over again, if we'd been able to go back and redo the things that the legislature had done before, I feel sure that most of us would have said, well, let's use some of this money for capital improvements and for needed social and other services, other governmental services. But let's hold back some of it as a sort of a capital fund. Well, the trouble about saying that as a policy is that it never happens. There's a pile of money sitting there, and everybody wants a piece of it. So the only way to protect the fund, assuming you like that sort of thing, and assuming you believe it's good to set aside those monies for future use, and the only way to do it, because you cannot dedicate funds because of our constitutional provision, which incidentally I think is a wise one, then it can only be done through a constitutional amendment, which of course we did try to do it through a bill. The governor vetoed it, and then a bill came in to do it through constitutional amendment, a resolution rather. So that will be on the ballot in November. Now, there are a lot of things that go into the concept of the permanent fund that are not discussed necessarily. It's kind of being sold as a bread and butter or a motherhood issue or something like that, which is fine as long as it's sold. But one of the things that perhaps isn't being put across very clearly is the notion that Alaska's resources are in fact owned by the public, owned by the taxpayers, the residents of the state of Alaska. You know, everybody knows that sort of, but they don't, I don't think it's sunk in. You talk to the average person on the street, a public resource is something for the government to play with. It doesn't have anything to do with him. Now, I think that a non-renewable resource, such as oil, gas, metals, should be, the revenue from those resources should be, a certain portion should be put away so that future generations who come along after those resources are long gone and forgotten will have some benefit, will derive some benefit from those resources. Now the word benefit, of course, is kind of flexible. You can just save it up and use the interest on the money later on to operate schools and this sort of thing, or you can invest the money in renewable resources such as the fisheries, timber resources, agriculture, and other things that would serve to put Alaska in a little better position economically so that we don't have to depend solely on the oil and gas industry. All of these things went into the thought that underlay the permanent fund. I think we'll talk a lot about it, and I don't want to dwell on that. One of the things that we discussed or that was discussed during the past legislative session was a possible constitutional amendment which would say essentially that public resources are in trust for the people of Alaska. It's a new concept. It's been batted back and forth loosely, I think, for a couple of years. It's based on the notion that a public resource is a public trust, and it's up to whoever's operating, running the show down there, to use it for the maximum possible benefit of the people. Well, of course, that means a lot of things to a lot of different people, and frankly, I do not support that concept as a constitutional amendment. I do think that the concept has a lot of merit, but I don't think that sort of thing ought to be added into the Constitution, which I think is the reason that we're here today. We do have Article 8, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the state resources shall be used for the maximum benefit of the people. I think that's close enough. But that's perhaps one of the things that we might discuss here today on this panel, is this proposed constitutional amendment which would specify that public resources would be used as a public trust, whatever that means. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cooper. Next, Mr. Erickson.
So just two, I've been boning up for this. I found an article in the 1962 issue of the Legislative Council that discussed tax revenues. And I'll only cite two of the six major bases for tax revenue, and we've already touched on one. It says the second one is that you cannot tax you must have an economic base, and you must know how and appraise the economic assets of your state. Two, you cannot tax the base so as to impair the productivity of that base. You must know what the tax proposal's effect is on the taxpayer. And of course, that's where some of our major developing companies that want to develop things say that the oil companies say we should not overtax because we will destroy the basis for it. And the proposed permanent fund it isn't so much, I think, an issue of the permanent fund, is that how that permanent fund will be administered, what will be the rules, how will the money be spent. Yesterday, Paul Hildesacker suggested that we follow the rules. We're going to have so much money that we ought to follow the lead of, you mentioned one of the major insurance companies that set aside $500 million, I think, for investment in a portion of in high-risk third world enterprises, that we have a responsibility to do that. Another thing that we must consider, and this is really not a constitutional matter, but so much of this real item is that item of the permanent fund, is that we're going to have so much money there, that we may run out of that. We don't know. We have discovered no other major oil fields since Pluto Bay, and they tell us that the likelihood of an intrastate oil field discovery is rather remote. We can't consider the offshore one because that's federal, and that if we do not, if we bond ourselves for expenditures for to spend that money, we may run out of this oil before the before we pay off the debt. So we've got to think about husbanding our resources. And I noticed that Sterling Gallagher says that he has been able to reduce the term of long-term indebtedness down from 99 years at maturity to year 99 to 20 years or so. So we will not be saddled with this at a time when we may not have the money. I do notice one thing. You mentioned that we don't have enough time to discuss the possibility. We haven't discussed do we need a constitutional convention. There's something coming up I'd like to recommend to all of us that we participate in, and that's the Alaska Public Forum, which is being sponsored by the Alaska Policy Growth Council, in which we will have opportunities in our various communities to discuss these things, and perhaps that's a place where we can really get down to a hard discussion on whether we need a constitutional convention and what we should contain in that constitutional convention. I noticed that if you observe the in Norway, they're taxing their oil at a much greater rate than we are even proposing to tax it. So we shouldn't be bound too closely by this worry that we're going to kill the goose that lays this golden egg, because there may be only one golden egg and we're not going to have any more of them. I feel kind of strange. I was listed as a public advisor. I'm sort of like the rest of you, as sort of a gadfly, perhaps, a convincer. I do notice, Mr. Wolfert.
Excuse me, the advisor, the tape is about to run out. I guess.